It's the Chicken Soup edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Nuking the Moon, Gideon Bible Update from BC Humanist's own Ian Bushfield, The End of Shellfish, and the Mythology of Chicken Soup. Let's begin episode 191.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
My name is Don, your political science philosopher.
Almost forgot there.
Almost. I've been trying to take these memory pills and I keep forgetting to take them. It's one of the faults in that whole system.
Yeah, that doesn't work out when the memory and the pills,
you forget to take them.
Right.
So, Ian, I came across an interesting story this week. Picture yourself in the U.S. military.
Okay.
World War II is fresh on the mind. World War III seems just around the corner. The evil USSR has captured space by launching the first satellite and then the first manned spacecraft into orbit. You need something to ensure that the U.S. is still seen as number one to stop the Red Horde. Solution? Blow up the moon. In a project called A119, a study of lunar research flights, an actual plan was created in order to launch a nuclear missile to the moon and detonate it there. A scene that seems quite out of some cheesy spy novel. I mean, really, it was kind of weird, but hey, someone said this might be a good idea. The thought, of course, was to scare off the USSR from attempting a moon landing. Sort of like, see what we did to Japan? We proved that we can do the same thing on the moon, so we can blow up your moon colony. So back off, Ruskies. Or at least that's kind of what I picture going on in someone's mind. Again, some cheesy spy novel sort of thing. The blast, of course, would also be seen by the naked eye, so they were thinking, hey, this would be another way to sort of create a bunch of enthusiasm in the United States and saying, hey, see that bright flash? That's American know-how. Of course, the plan was eventually scrapped as saner minds realized that they were kind of unsure what the blast effects would be on the planet Earth, such as creating perhaps a radioactive cloud that would envelop the entire planet. Not to mention, of course, ending the possibility of future manned landings on the moon. I mean, after all, again, you blow up a bomb, lots of radiation, and that could be a little hazardous for any astronaut, cosmonaut, or chrononaut that might be up there. I think chrononaut's the Chinese version.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, just also, debris from the moon exploding could also, perhaps cause some damage.
Yes.
Falling into the sky and then smashing into buildings, I mean.
Radioactive or otherwise, perhaps we've discovered another reason why the dinosaurs became extinct. Maybe they had reached, this sort of level of technology where they could launch a nuclear missile to the moon. And you had the, pterosaurs versus the plesiosaurs. And they said, wow, we can't let them get there, so we're going to blow up part of the moon. And that was, unlikely, of course. The other thing that they were saying was that, sure, this would sort of scare the Russians perhaps away, the Soviets away, but it would also pretty much, scare the hell out of everyone else on the planet as well. So perhaps not the best of ideas. One of the people who may have persuaded the planners to abandon the project was a new grad student who did some work on the effects of what all that dust and debris would do when it was created. And of course, this, I think, led to the whole idea of nuclear winter. Of course, the young scientist in question is none other than the skeptic hero, Carl Sagan. Lastly, the crazy was on both sides of the Iron Curtain. As much as we like to think the Americans are totally nuts, Soviets were too, because they had a very similar plan, but slightly wiser, because in their plan, they had three manned missions before they blew up the moon.
Right.
So,
a little bit wiser.
Just slightly.
Yeah.
Of course, ultimately, they all said, screw it, not really that worth, not that important. No, not that important, that's not the right word. They just said, we're not crazy. Yeah. One at the moon? That's crazy.
Well, given the fact that it was already fairly difficult to get to the moon, sending a nuke there would have been kind of a waste of some pretty valuable resources.
True, true. And actually, that was the one thing. You know, the Americans' largest bomb was a hydrogen bomb, but they had no effective way to carry a bomb that heavy up there, so they had to go for a lighter, quote-unquote, nuclear bomb.
Right, right. Well, that was led to the whole debate over ICBMs and, you know, we talked about the Avro Arrow, for example, which was because of these sort of slow-moving missiles that could be shot down.
Yes. So, yeah, no, that was one of those little tidbits of history. And, of course, the little skeptical angle there of Carl Sagan coming in and, you know, a grad student and finding out, you know, maybe blowing up nuclear bombs will have more implications than just the bomb itself. And, of course, like I say, we all know about nuclear winter, which actually I guess a lot of our listeners might not be so into. But it was something that when I was growing up, was always on the top of your mind because nuclear war was always right there.
Well, yeah, it was the global warming of its day.
Yes. Yes, actually, you know, it was. With the slight difference is that we managed to, well, I guess stop it. I'm not quite sure if that's right, because we still have nuclear bombs, but we no longer have that sort of hair trigger.
Yeah.
Whereas today with global warming, we kind of said, oh no, global warming will destroy the planet. And then we kind of said, well, maybe it won't. And then we're kind of like, fuck it.
Yeah, so we'll have to see how that one develops. Maybe in, you know, a couple hundred years, the big threat will be, I don't know, some other combination of temperature and disaster.
Yes. Well, I'm quite sure global warming will come up again.
Oh, it might. In today's show.
Yes. But before we get to that, I think we should do an interview.
An interview, Don?
Yes. We actually, we talked about Gideon Bibles in schools a few shows ago. And apparently there's been quite a lot of movement on the topic, and I got in touch with the BC Humanists Association's own Ian Bushfield, and we did a bit of a talk about what's been going on with the whole Bibles in school thing. Today, listeners, we have Ian Bushfield, Executive Director of the BC Humanists Association, here again in our Radio Freethinker virtual studio.
Hi, Don.
We have covered on the show recently a debate that arose out of the distribution of Gideon Bibles in Chilliwack. At that time, the practice was to be continued, but so has the debate. The BC Humanist Association has seen this as an important issue. The situation has changed greatly since we last reported on it, and the scope has also increased. From what I understand, your group has created a campaign around this issue called Secular Schools, with at least one of its aims to prevent the distribution of Bibles, or in fact, any religious text, at a public school. What's it all about?
Yeah, so the issue we see is that promoting or distributing Bibles in schools sort of infringes on the separation of church and state. BC School Act says that public schools need to be strictly secular and non-sectarian, and our group doesn't think any one religious dogma should be endorsed to the exclusion of all other beliefs or no beliefs. You know, our schools don't exist for religions and faith groups to proselytize.
Well, you know, is it really wrong? I mean, in one sense, I know you have the issue with proselytizing, and of course, us at Radio Free Thinker are much on board on this, but I mean, these are being donated to the school. It's a voluntary basis. I mean, students, they have to get permission slips from the parents before they can receive them. Why is this really such a big issue?
It's giving an unfair access to what is our most precious resource, our children. We don't have open access to students in schools. It's just not what our school systems are for.
Well, what about if you just, you know, let it open to everybody so everyone can distribute their holy text? I mean, isn't that one of the bases of the idea of freedom of speech and freedom of association?
Well, we have no issue with students learning about different ideas and different religions, but I think the focus of school needs to be on education and critical thinking rather than sort of funneling religious ideologies directly to children uncritically. It sort of gives it a stamp of approval. If you even think about it, not all religions or worldviews are very evangelical. You know, they don't push their views out there. So if you open it up to everyone, you're only going to get those very active faiths going out there. And they won't get to actually learn about other ones.
And of course, there's also the idea of peer pressure and social pressure that, you know, by not going up and getting the free Bible is, in a way, a statement of your belief system in a public way that you may or may not be comfortable with.
Exactly. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association wrote a letter to Chilliwack School Board actually for their meeting a couple weeks ago, and they said just that, you know, this permission slip forces parents and students to take a stand on a religious question. And while you can do that voluntarily, you shouldn't be forced to do that.
So if this sort of movement, you know, to prevent the distribution of the Bibles occur, there is the potential for some negative ramifications. I mean, for example, you know, if we were trying to distribute some atheist, humanist, or skeptical literature, some groups up there would claim that this is actually non-secular. Are you worried about any kind of blowback?
Well, we've never had our goal to proselytize in public schools. If we want to reach people, we do it on equal ground, religious organizations.
So what role do you think, I mean, what if this was part of a philosophy class and they offered to distribute the books in that, would that be okay?
Well, in a philosophy or comparative ethics class, you can act, there's no reason the Bible or other literature shouldn't be there. It needs to be there if you're going to discuss it. But then it's put in context and it's not sort of given a rubber stamp of approval from the public school system.
Okay, so that's a good understanding sort of what's the why of the issue. But what's the state now in the province? Who's winning, secularists or the Bible pushers?
I think we're doing well as secularists. Chilliwack, the school board there, repealed their regulation that permitted Gideon Bible distribution. That one's an interesting case that I'll come back to in a second. Powell River, just a couple of days ago, was the only other district that explicitly permitted Gideon Bibles. And at their meeting on Tuesday night, they actually just straight up repealed the provision that allowed Gideon Bibles. I don't know if they'd actually distributed them in a while, and it might have just been an old message on the books that they finally cleaned up. And there was actually a district, Okanagan-Similkameen, that had a weird advertising rule that said all advertisements in schools must be non-secular. And I think that was just a typo, but I did make them aware of that, and they appreciated that, and they fixed it, like, right away. So those three are fixed. Now, coming back to Chilliwack, what it seemed like the board there decided was the policy, or the regulation, sorry, was sort of an anomaly, because typically the board writes policy and the staff had written regulations. But in this case, the board sort of created a regulation. So they seem to have repealed this policy, deleted this policy or regulation, just as it doesn't belong like this. And the board has decided that they will write a new policy that will allow the distribution of materials for March. And our group will be working with the BC Civil Liberties Association's legal team to find ways to make sure whatever policy they do try to bring in, if they get one, follows the School Act and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
So it sounds bad that you have another fight on your hands, but at least, you know, I think our side will be better prepared for it. The way I understand the original Chilliwack issue, it kind of came out from nowhere because one parent just sort of said, hey, what's up with this?
Yeah, definitely. He's a very active person on Twitter, and he's been a very strong advocate to keep his school secular. And so we're glad to have him raise the issue. But it has sort of sparked it to help us build a coalition of, you know, secular advocates who are now becoming aware of this issue. And sort of over the next year, that's sort of what I want this secular school campaign to become, is one where we reach out to parents and teachers across BC and find out the stories of what's going on. I got one email from an anonymous teacher in Abbotsford who's really worried that his public elementary school is going to be doing their Christmas concert, and it's Christmas, in a church, and the church will require their public school children to sing religious songs.
Sounds like a crossing of the border between sort of church and state, which I guess technically is not unconstitutional in Canada, but definitely not something we like to promote.
Well, here in BC, the School Act, Section 76, does say public schools have to be strictly secular and non-sectarian. So there is a legal precedent. And to my understanding, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms has upheld sort of the separation of church and state in its own way. So we have our own laws here protecting secularism.
That's good. So this has been largely an issue that's been in the public school area. But there are a number of private and homeschooling people who get government funding, if I understand correctly, to educate children. Do you think this is something that would be moved into that area or something that you wouldn't want to touch?
Personally, I hope to one day sort of raise the issue of the independent schools. Many of them are sort of just private schools that exist for very good reasons. Right, the closest independent school to my house is a special school where they focus purely on children with dyslexia. And, you know, they can focus resources because they have that freedom. And that might be something society values. Others might see it as a two-tiered education system. But on the other hand, there's a lot of very religious schools in the independent school system, both Catholic and evangelical Christian. I know there was one case a year or two ago where a Catholic school in Vancouver actually fired a teacher because she was a lesbian. And I don't know if that fits well with sort of the tolerant pluralism we like in BC.
Yes, actually, no, it seems to be almost antithetical to that idea. I'm not sure if you're aware of, and I may be pushing your boundaries here, but in Alberta right now, there's a large issue going on where they've rewritten, I believe, the education law that has removed references to the Alberta's Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And this is something that was pushed by homeschoolers in an effort to ensure that they can have a very non-secular education for their children. They're allowed to say anything they want in the guise of education. Are you aware of this issue at all?
I'm aware of it. I'm not aware of it in BC yet, which is good, I guess. I grew up in Alberta, so I went through the public education system there. And Alberta's a very interesting case because they also have the Catholic school boards that are fully funded. So they're funding one specific faith 100% in every district. And then the homeschoolers, I guess, have a lot of influence over the public education system, which presents quite a challenge, and I am quite concerned that they have deleted essentially human rights from the curriculum.
Yeah, it was quite odd. I was listening to a podcast where they tried to defend it, and the best he could come up with is, well, if you wanted to deny the Holocaust, could you? And he said, well, I should have that right to teach my children. And I was like, not the battle you want to have.
Yeah, that's Godwin himself.
Exactly. Well, I think we've covered a fair bit. Do you see anything coming up in the future with regards to this issue of Bibles in schools besides the one you had mentioned in Chilliwack in a few months?
Well, I know it's still going on in Abbotsford under a distribution of materials policy. And sort of as we craft our legal response with the BCCLA for Chilliwack, we'll probably be applying that same sort of test case against Abbotsford as well. And we're also going to be listening because there are rumors of other districts where this happens, whether it's explicitly permitted by district policies or not.
Is there anything that our listeners could do to help out?
They can always support us financially because we're always in need of a little bit more funding. The churches have a lot more than us, so they can go to bchumanist.ca and find out about our current fundraising campaign.
Well, thank you, Ian, for this update. And it's an issue that we're going to keep in touch with in the future. Again, thank you for coming on down.
Thank you very much, Don.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlach, Chairman.
This guy standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Audiopile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks to Ian for that interview.
Yes, thank you very much, Ian. And hopefully, again, you know, we enjoy participating with the local skeptic community. Invite anyone who has a particular issue or update or information to contact us, and maybe you can get yourself on the show. So we're not distributing Bibles at Radio Free Thinker. We are distributing knowledge and a healthy dose of skepticism, and more on health later in the show. But right now, Ethan, you know, last show we talked about the end of, no, what did we talk about at the end of last year?
Well, there was coffee.
We destroyed coffee. Yeah. Then we got rid of
something else.
Yeah, damn. Well, you know, in the same theme of it's the end of, oh, Twinkies. That was it. It was the end of coffee, the end of Twinkies, end of my memory. So those goddamn memory pills, I really need to take them. Now it's the end of oysters, our shellfish in general. Well, maybe not. I might be overstating it a little bit. But in another study, the British Antarctic Survey has shown that we have increased the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere and it is changing our environment in devastating ways. We often think of CO2 as a greenhouse gas, which it is, but as concentrations increase due to human activity, the environment attempts to maintain homeostasis. Homeostasis is a fancy term that refers to the property of a system to regulate its internal environment in an attempt to maintain a stable and relative constant condition. I paid $10 for that word. As we increase the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, we upset this balance. The Earth attempts to regain balance by removing excess CO2. One way the planet removes excess CO2 from the atmosphere is to dissolve it into water, such as oceans. Over the past several decades, the acidity of the world's oceans has been constantly rising. Now, the oceans, of course, are huge. So, to be fair, the increase has been somewhat minor, but it's been constant. That said, since the beginning of the industrial era, our oceans have become roughly 30% more acidic. Actually, they've reached an acidity peak that we haven't seen on the planet for over 55 million years. It appears that we are approaching another tipping point where these minor changes can trigger a major reaction. In this case, the possible extinction of shellfish. Goodbye oysters, clams, and maybe even shrimp and lobster. Okay, now you may be saying, Don, that's ridiculous. The oceans are nowhere near acidic enough to, like, burn sea life. And if it did, it would, like, kill it all. So to that, I'd say yes and no. So let me explain. Shellfish are called that because they have shells. Ironically enough, not because they're fish, which they're not. Actually, they're mostly mollusks and crustaceans. But anyhow, the shell is composed of calcium carbonate. Ethan, can you take a guess at what compound is easily dissolved in acidic water?
Would it be calcium carbonate?
Yes! So this means that the shells can literally be dissolved away. What the study, published in Nature Geoscience, identifies is what we may call the canary in the coal mine. It showed that shellfish of marine snails, known as pseudopods, or more colorfully, sea butterflies, living in the seas around the Antarctic, are being dissolved by ocean acidification. The team examined an area of upwelling where winds cause cold water to be pushed up from the depths to the surface. Upwellings are more corrosive for a particular kind of calcium carbonate, something called aragonite, which pseudopods and most mollusks, like clams, mussels, oysters, use to build their shells. The team found that as a result of the additional influence of ocean acidification, this corrosive water severely dissolved the shells of these pteropods. Snails and other shellfish do not necessarily die from their shells being dissolved. However, it does increase their vulnerability to predation, infection, and consequently has a major impact on our food web. So it's not like, you know, they're actually being roasted or cooked by this acidity. It's as the shells dissolve, they essentially lose their only major defense mechanism they have. So why do we care? Well, these tiny animals are actually a valuable food source for other animals. They play a major role as grazers of plankton, and then they get fed upon by higher predators, such as larger plankton, fish, seabirds, and whales. They also play an important role in the ocean carbon cycle. One way that CO2 is removed permanently from the atmosphere is sequestration in the ocean's depth. The inorganic CO2 in the shells of animals, like the sea butterfly, fuels a carbon pump that removes organic carbon from the active regions of the ocean and lays it out as sediment on the ocean bottom. Ethan, you drive a CO2-producing vehicle, so why do you hate oysters, or are you just out to kill the lobsters?
Well, it's true. I really don't like lobsters. And frankly, I'm kind of surprised. I mean, if we can melt away their shells, why don't, when we cook lobster, if you pour acid in it, then I don't have to, you know, pull the shell off. It can just melt away. It seems so convenient.
Yes. Well, one, it does take a little while for this to happen.
Oh.
So it's not like it happens instantly. And I would not doubt that there is probably method to cooking madness that does that. Although part of the acidification process deals with lower temperatures and higher pressures. So I think the fact that you are throwing the poor lobster that you hate so much into the boiling pot of hot water actually helps make the shell stronger.
Really? Interesting. Well, you mentioned the fact that it's the water coming from the depths where it's more acidic. So why is it more acidic at the depth? Wouldn't it be... I'm just kind of thinking with the salt water that would actually be... That would be better for them.
Yeah, no, so this involves a bit of chemistry that I must confess I'm not 100% up on. But as you go lower down the water column, temperatures decrease and pressure increases. And there's a certain level where you have sort of the... there's a certain amount that can be dissolved into the water. And that reaches sort of a critical level at about 1,000 meters below the ocean waters.
Mm.
But as we pump more and more CO2 into the water... And this area where the calcium carbonate dissolves easily rises. So where it was 1,000 feet before, now they're finding it in areas as low as 200 meters, which is why the upwelling in this story was particularly important, because it's showing that this demarcation point of where it would be. So if you had these shellfish below 1,000 feet, they would be shellless to begin with, because that's a point where it just naturally dissolves.
Right.
But the acidification is essentially raising that level up for us.
You know, another where impact this is going to have could be on all those shows on the Discovery Channel about fishing.
Yes. Well, yes. No. How?
Well, you know those shows where they go up to the Arctic Circle and fish for those giant crab things, and it's always like, you know... Yeah, is it the toughest job in the world? And then it's like you go up there and like all the crab, you don't have any shells. No one wants to eat them. And then it's like, oh, now our livelihood.
Yeah, but now what they're going to have is they're going to take the people who make the zombie movies and they're going to have them do makeup on them. Because in order to show the melting of the shells, you're going to have like, you know, there's one of those 11-foot long giant crabs. But they're going to show a shell literally dripping off of it. And you go, ah! Or something.
I bet zombie crabs would be probably more expensive than regular crabs.
True, but so this, one of the things about this is the idea is that the ocean acidification is increasing, and one of the ways that we witness it is through this idea of shellfish literally being dissolved out of their shells. There are other areas that we're not touching on particularly here where this also plays into it. It's the whole idea of ocean reefs, coral reefs, and that sort of thing. Because coral reefs, again, use calcium carbonate to form up their shells, and as the acidic balance shifts, their ability to do this shifts as well. And implicit in kind of what I mentioned before, I mean, 55 million years ago, we had the same acidity. So again, we're not talking so much, oh my God, it's the end of life as we know it. But then again, it is the end of life as we know it. So will there be some form of shellfish existing? Probably, because there'll be some animal out there that will learn to adapt and change its chemistry in such a way as to continue to exist, but things like oysters and all that may literally disappear. And then that has a runoff effect because we've developed an ecosystem that is dependent upon these particular animals, and it just collapses because the change is happening so quickly. And that's the other aspect that we don't really mention in this, is that it's been a super snap in biogeological time.
Right. I mean, it's not simply a matter of pulling out cards out of the house of cards. It's doing them all at once.
Exactly. Because, again, this, you know, nature, evolution, it adapts, it balances eventually. But things, as we know them, will disappear. It's just a shame.
Well, we're going to disappear for a couple of minutes, but we'll be back after these commercial breaks here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC,
It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you.
And we're back. You know, Ethan, that last topic has just left me shell-shocked. Sorry, I've been working on that one all day. We talked about nuking the moon. We have Bibles in our school. You know, it's making me feel run down. I'm feeling a little under the weather. It's that time of year. You know, I'm kind of sick. Is there anything out there, Ethan, that might help me feel a little better?
Don, have you ever had some chicken soup?
Yes. In fact, I have had some chicken soup.
Because that's the topic of our next segment here on Radio Free Thinker. You know, as Don mentioned, it's cold and flu season. There's a pretty good chance that some of our listeners right now are battling the cold or the flu. And as such, they've probably been offered all manner of unproven treatments to help speed up their recovery. Everything from vitamin C to echinacea to cold FX.
Fake.
Yes. And those little treatments, they're highly dubious. But what about chicken soup? Because that's something that gets prescribed to me pretty often. I'm sure most of our listeners have heard it. And it's one of the most recommended cures. So my question is, does it actually have curative powers? And, well, sort of. So here's the deal. Chicken soup, since the time of ancient Greece / Jewish / Chinese or pretty much any other culture or civilization, was seen to have restorative powers. Everything from ammonia to a running nose, chicken soup was the thing to take. Additionally, chicken soup was also considered a very pious meal, a very spiritually restorative meal, which perhaps fits particularly well within the Jewish tradition, where it has sort of been associated with having not just a good physical body, but also a physical or a spiritual relationship with God that is healthy and robust. And
I wonder how.
I don't know, actually.
Probably has something to do with egg magic, because it all has to do something with egg magic.
Probably. I mean, I guess chickens are, I don't know, particularly pious, maybe. In modern-day society, chicken soup has maintained its restored reputation, both physically and spiritually. The idea of treating something with chicken soup is actually a common expression. So you've heard of the book series Chicken Soup for the Soul. That's a reference to this. So anytime you have a problem, chicken soup is the solution to whatever problem that you may have. Now, it's not surprising that given the history, scientists wouldn't at some point start testing chicken soup in the lab. And what would they discover? Is chicken soup is it a bust, or is there something to this folk remedy? And the answer appears to be a definitive maybe. In a study in 1978, chicken soup was tested in lab conditions to see what effect it would have on the cold. 15 subjects were tested before and at 5 and 30 minute intervals after drinking either hot water by sip or a straw, hot chicken soup by sip or a straw, and cold water by sip. Turns out hot water by sip increased nasal mucus velocity from 6.2 to 8.4 millimeters per minute, which is both gross and fascinating.
I was going to say, was that, you know, accelerated, or was that just in its natural state?
I think 6.2 is sort of the average, and then upping it to 8.4 is the effect of the hot water there. Hot chicken soup by sip went from 6.9 to 9.2, and chicken soup by straw from 6.4 to 7.8. That's after 5 minutes of administration, but it went back to normal after about 30 minutes. Now, this is statistically significant compared to, say, just cold water, which didn't really have any increase or decrease whatsoever. They concluded that drinking hot fluids increases nasal mucus velocity in part through the inhalation of water vapor. Hot chicken soup, either through the aroma sensed in the posterior nares or through a mechanism related to taste, appears to possess an additional substance for increasing nasal mucus velocity.
And I think that was one of the important reasons why they did the test both with a sip and with a straw. With a sip, you not only get the drinking of the chicken soup or hot water, but you also get the aromatics, whereas with a straw, you're just getting sort of the medicine by itself.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, typically when you're sipping soup, it's right up to your face, right? So you're getting it right towards your nose. So what are the rational explanations for these? The effect of heat and steam seems fairly important. It does temporarily speed up the movement of mucus. It also possibly helps relieve congestion and limiting the amount of time viruses are in contact with the nose lining. It also acts as an anti-inflammatory by inhibiting the movement of neutrophils, immune cells that participate in the body's inflammatory response. So by inhibiting these immune system responses, you're lessening the symptoms of the cold, because that's, you know, what is giving you those unfortunate symptoms.
Of course, you know, less time with viruses. If you're already infected, you already have the virus in you. That doesn't seem to be a big thing.
No, I don't think it's
but the other part's good.
Terribly relevant. So in a recent study in the 2000s, it was documented that the ingredients of chicken soup seem to have this anti-inflammatory effect.
I'm curious, and you may not know this, but so when they say the ingredients, do they mean chicken in hot water, or do they mean chicken, some celery, some carrots? Because I mean, when I have chicken soup, it's more than just boiled chicken.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's other things that go into it.
So there's some debate about that, because some recipes seem to work better than others do at lessening symptoms. Appears to be, and I'll get onto this a bit later, there seems to be some effect of the chicken that's not present in other foods. So we'll have more on that in a couple of seconds. The other big factor is rehydration and easy feeding that comes part and parcel with chicken soup. So when you're sick, you know, being malnutritioned impairs the immune system. So anytime you take in nutrients, you're going to feel a bit better. And that's one of the benefits that, say, chicken soup has over just hot water, is that you also are getting some food in there as well. And that's going to increase your ability to fight the virus. Another factor might be zinc. There are some clinical trials that indicate that zinc can reduce the duration and severity of cold symptoms if taken within a 24-hour onset of the cold. Now, unfortunately, the dose needs to be about 50 milligrams a day. And chicken soup, although it's high in zinc, only contains about 5 milligrams a serving. So you'd have to drink a lot of chicken soup. Oysters contain about 100.
So what we're recommending here is to swap out your chicken soup for oyster soup or maybe clam chowder.
Yeah, assuming that we don't melt their shells. More recent studies have suggested that kerosene, a natural antioxidant that is found exclusively in meat, including chicken.
Kerosene is something very different.
I see. Anyway, may provide a benefit as well. The thing with that is that it's broken down so rapidly once you ingest it that little, if any, would reach the nose to provide relief. So far, studies haven't tested whether chicken soup is really effective in fighting the common cold, and they haven't really compared it to, say, standard medical intervention. So there's no real, scientifically controlled study comparing chicken soup to Tylenol, for example. We don't really have that information. But it does seem to be that chicken soup does have, at the very least, some effect. And some limited studies have shown that there actually does seem to be something a little bit to its ability to at least lessen the severity of your cold or flu. So what's interesting about all this is you might say, well, What exactly is causing it, though? Because, you know, if we can't figure out what magic ingredient there is in chicken soup that's making you feel better, maybe there are some other reasons that it's happening. And these reasons could actually be psychological. And yes, placebo effect, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, that's kind of boring. When you're sick, you know, you don't really feel like eating anything. You feel cold, you're weak, you're irritable. And then along comes this chicken soup, which makes you, you know, feel better. It's got some food, it's warm. And the psychological effect of having someone make chicken soup for you and give it to you will have a big impact on making you feel more comfortable, more cared for. It's that, you know, palliative aspect of it that has a strong psychological impact on you.
And it also goes in, too, with the whole culture, you know, like it's mom's chicken soup. And, you know, when you have it, you think back when you were young and how mom would take care of everything. And there's a lot of, I think, that psychological aspect built into it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another way that chicken soup would seem to make you better is the timing of when you take it. Usually you get a cold long before you realize you actually have it. You start to feel a little off, a bit stuffed up, runny nose, but it's not so bad. You know, a day or two later, it gets worse and worse, and pretty soon you have symptoms that are so bad, you know, you may not be able to go to work or go to school or whatever it is you do. It's at this point, typically, where most people start to medicate. And so, you know, this is also where things start to get better pretty quickly. Usually your symptoms kind of go up really high, like a hockey stick, and then down pretty fast. So you take something, whether say it's chicken soup or echinacea or cold FX, and start to feel better, you're going to naturally assume it's what you took that makes you feel better.
Correlation versus causation.
Of course. But the thing with the cold or the flu is that if you get it and do nothing, you're going to be sick about 5 to 10 days. If you get it and do something, you're going to be sick for about 5 to 10 days. It just depends on, can you live with your symptoms? You can soldier through and have a runny nose and a sore throat, or you can take Tylenol or Advil or whatever and, you know, reduce those symptoms enough to go to work. Well, but you're not really curing it.
Well, no, and actually you bring up another interesting too is confounding figures. I mean, you sit there and you remember the chicken soup because it's so nice, but you don't remember the fact that you might have also taken a decongestant or some other such thing. And actually that reminds me of a joke about Grandma's moonshine cure. Right, you know, if you start feeling a cold, you take a couple of glasses of Grandma's moonshine. It doesn't cure your cold, but you don't care you have it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, and I think that has that same impact with chicken soup. I mean, sort of the old joke is, you know, you get the man cold. You know, it's just like, oh, I'm dying. No one cares about me. I'll just curl up and die. And then, you know, your mom or your grandma or your wife comes along with this nice hot bowl of chicken soup. And it's like, ooh, everyone taking nice care of me. And, you know, then it just makes you feel better. And I think a lot of that is what goes into, you know, making chicken soup have the reputation as healing. And then, of course, you get the extra benefits that there actually could be a couple interesting avenues where science could say, hey, it does actually have some restorative powers here.
No, and exactly. And just like with anything else, I mean, we're not really advocating, hey, chicken soup is going to cure you here. We're exploring some of this. But anything that's sort of quote-unquote folk medicine, you know, the scientific process comes in and it says, well, is there anything here at all? And sometimes it will find some things, as you mentioned, you know, the idea of warm water and a slight aromatic stimulating the nasal cavity so as to increase the flow of mucus. Well, you know, you determine, yes, it does. And then it goes from folk remedy to medicine, and it becomes actually sort of a real medical sort of cure, even if it is done in a folksy sort of way.
Right. And the other thing, too, with your sore throat, obviously keeping hydrated and, you know, moisturizing your throat like that is going to, you know, prevent that kind of really painful, phlegmy experience. And again, chicken soup can easily accomplish that.
And, you know, chickens is one of the first animals that became domesticated. So in an odd sort of way, there is that sort of attachment why it's so entrenched into a lot of cultures. Because one of the things I was thinking about, well, how come we don't have this thing over, you know, beef soup or beef broth or duck soup or something like that? And I mean, I guess from my cultural heritage, I don't think that exists. But then again, maybe it does. I wonder if there is an equivalent for this in Native American cultures, be it South or North, because again, chickens are not native to the Americas. So mm-hmm. Do they have some other sort of aromatic liquid that they used as well?
Well, I mean, in theory, anything that is hot and liquid will have some effect. We saw that with the study. So in theory, you could make a soup out of fish or oysters or just even plants and herbs. So, I mean, in theory, yes. What's interesting about chicken soup is how it's taken on such a more profound effect on popular culture, and then it's become this kind of catch-allism for folk remedies, but also just kind of like, if you have a problem, it's like, oh, chicken soup, you know. If you're spiritually in crisis, you know, you might say, oh, well, if you go to church, that's your chicken soup, you know. And it's just taken on this added meaning, which is not too bad. I mean, I think it's better than, say, for example, homeopathy taking on a bigger cultural impact than it already has.
Well, that's the thing I was thinking about. I'm rapidly going through my brain saying, I wonder what the origin of the virus for the cold and flu is, and if it's actually in chickens.
We're constantly infecting ourselves.
Well, no, you know, they're saying, well, you know, a little bit of the bad thing, which was the chicken, helps cure it. But you know what, again, I think maybe you're right, as in there may be more to this, because one of the other things that used to be a common cure but isn't anymore because it's so hard to do is things like mustard poultices and plasters. You know, if you watch some of the older shows, or if you do any research into the history of medicine itself, if you got a cold or you got a flu or something like that, one of the first things they would do is they'd take something that was highly aromatic and usually actually quite hot and slather it over your chest as a curative for that. The idea is sort of the heat was supposed to draw out the poisons and the smell was supposed to clear out the nasal passages. And I mean, most of those were pretty horrific things to go through. And it seems like, you know, chicken soup, one, wasn't horrific. But two, in order to make those sort of poultices and plasters, you had to actually kind of know sort of what you were doing, even if it was a folk medicine sort of way. But, I mean, anyone could go to Safeways or whatever, grab a can of soup, heat it up, and then, it's good. Although, sorry, and my mind tends to wander like that, like this, leads to another issue, is how much of chicken is in actually chicken soup that we get today. I mean, I think chicken soup is one of those things that they now make artificially, and it's not actually boiled chicken. It's actually some chemical stew that they've created. So, I mean, maybe chicken soup doesn't even have chicken anymore. What does that do to your soul?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, when I was reading about the studies that were comparing different recipes, the assumption would be that, you know, grandma's recipe is the most powerful. So they compared, some of the researchers had the recipes from their, you know, grandparents or whatever. And the ones that did the best, ironically, were like the store-bought brand name ones. I don't know what that means. Like maybe it's the purification process, perhaps. Who knows?
Chemical goodness.
Chemicals? Hey, I don't know. Maybe they have sort of a Kickstarter attempt. I don't, you know, it's the thing is, like, there are so many ingredients that go into chicken soup, and we know that, like, vegetables have good nutrients in them. They're going to be good for you. So if you get one that's loaded with carrots and, you know, onions and corn and chicken, and then the broth itself that maybe was boiled in it with chicken in it, that's going to have an impact. But likewise, I mean, even like a soup that's perhaps chicken soup in quotation marks, chicken removed for vegetarians and loaded with other stuff, that could have an impact as well, right?
True. And that just shows you that what really we need is we need to have more research into this. So I think we should start a letter-writing campaign to Campbell Soup saying we demand that they put billions of dollars into research to prove or disprove whether chicken soup is really a curative or not. Of course, if they did that, I'm sure we'd find in the pharmaceutical branch Campbell's chicken cold cure.
It is actually kind of interesting that they haven't exploited that marketing avenue. You know, put a little, like, label on chicken soup, clinically proven to reduce your cold and flu symptoms.
Yes. Well, maybe we should do some more. Maybe there's an opportunity for us.
Yeah, maybe we could, you
Radio
know.
Free Thinkers, chicken cold cure.
Absolutely. Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinkers, speaking of the show.
Yes.
We should probably go to our skeptical highlights.
Oh, and I got a few this week for you. So there's going to be a philosopher's jam. It's at Langara College, and they're going to be talking about, do people really have minds? And if they do, what good are they anyway? It's this Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m., the faculty and staff dining lounge at Langara. Cost is free. What you get is you get Wayne Henry will explore mental realism, the view that people really have minds, and that this is what we rely upon to explain intelligent behavior. Are minds distinct from our brains? Are there such things as minds, or are we just bodies? Dr. Henry will attempt to defend Jerry Fodor's theory of mental realism, and realism is the idea that there really are minds. He will also make a comparison to Paul and Patricia Churchland's prominent anti-realist alternatives, the view that there is sort of no objective reality, but all that we have is sort of created within our minds. Wayne Henry completed his PhD on conceptual foundations of cognitive science at the University of Western Ontario in 1994. He's a former faculty member at the Capilano University and policy analysis for Health Canada in Ottawa. He is currently an instructor at Langara College and the University of the Fraser Valley. So, Ethan, do you think you really have a mind?
I think I do.
Yes, and that's probably as far as it goes. I hate to confess that I would point myself in an anti-realist mode of thought, is that I think it's a nice idea to think that you really see the world. But so much of cognitive science, so much of what we talk about here about illusions of perception show that it's really a construct that we've created. But it's a good one, and I'm willing to run with it.
Okay.
My next one is Occupy the Economy, an evening with David Bersiman. This is Friday, November 30th from 6:30 p.m. at SFU's Harvard Center. It's free, but they do ask that you RSVP via Facebook. Renowned journalist and broadcaster and activist David Bersiman will offer attendees a critical look at the economic crisis in a changing world and speculate how we might act to prevent the future collapse. Bersiman is well known as a best-selling collaborator with famous intellectuals such as Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Edward Said. His latest book is Occupy the Economy, Challenging Capitalism. My last highlight for this week is Action Canada's Public Dialogue, Challenges and Change in Canada's Educational System, something very important to us here at Radio Free Thinker. It's happening Friday, November 30th, but don't worry, you get to catch both of those events because this one actually happens at 7:30 a.m. Do people really get up at 7:30 in the morning? I mean, seriously, that's way too early.
Sometimes they do.
And goes till about noon. This is at the Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, also at the SFU Harvard Center, also free. Action Canada's fellows, panel of experts, and members of the public will explore whether Canada has the educational system it needs to meet the socio-economical challenges of the future with different public policy perspectives. They will be discussing essentially three topics: standardized testing in Canada, teaching questions, not answers, and who cares about young caregivers. The moderator will be Tom Clark, chief political correspondent and host of the West Bloc on Global TV. Ethan, do you have any skeptical highlights?
I do. I actually also have a trio of highlights for the social skeptic. The first one is coming up this Friday. That is the 30th, for those keeping track at home. At 7 p.m., CFI Vancouver is hosting Dr. Thomas Kerr for a talk, The Science of Harm Reduction Drug Policy. That's happening in room A102 of Buchanan Building here at UBC. Dr. Thomas Kerr is the co-director of the Urban Health Research Initiative at British Columbia Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS, an associate professor of the Department of Medicine, a division of AIDS at the University of British Columbia. He's also a principal investigator in several large cohort studies involving people who inject drugs and individuals living with HIV/AIDS, and his primary research interests among people living with HIV is injection drug use and health policy and community-based research methods. So it's going to be a fantastic evening. Very relevant considering the recent court cases involving Insight here in Vancouver and involving more science in how we handle things like addiction and drug policy and going beyond the whole war on drugs into a more comprehensive policy. So I think this is going to be one of the most interesting talks that CFI has ever hosted. I'm looking forward to it very much.
And it being about drug policy and all that, forgive me, but will there be samplers?
There may be samples of orange juice.
Oh, well, okay.
My next skeptical highlight is the Freethinkers Book Club happening on the 8th of December, Saturday the 8th at 1 p.m. The book is Denialism. And this was written by Michael Spector, How Irrational Thinking Hinders Scientific Progress, Harms the Planet, and Threatens Our Lives. The book club meets on the second Saturday of the month at the Grind Coffee Shop on Main Street. Admission is free, and it's usually a great time.
Shellfish recommended, because they may not get it later, thanks to climate change.
Absolutely. And finally, Cafe Inquiry, CFI's monthly discussion group, on December 15th. Positive thinking for chronic pain, helpful or harmful? This is happening at 1 p.m. December 15th at SFU Harbor Center, room 1505, and 1 p.m. Should be another excellent discussion.
We really do need the brain pills.
We really do.
Yes.
Yeah, or chicken soup.
Well, yeah, let's go. Let's go and have some chicken soup right now.
Let's do it. Okay. Let's go. All right. Well, this is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy ride.